Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and I have invited author Jason Pratt to the show to talk about his new book, Cry of Justice. This is the first in a fantasy trilogy, so we are so excited to get to hear from him, not only about his first book, but where he's going really in this entire series. So I'm going to read you a quick bio that Jason sent me. I think he's being a little comedically humble here, so these aren't my words, but here it goes. Jason has one of the most boring and uninteresting author biographies known to humankind, which helps explain why he's writing an epic fantasy series in his spare time. He used to be fairly proficient at teaching all three sport fencing weapons and has studied strategic and tactical gaming for decades, which allows him to design his action scene at all scales, from wagering demonstration duel to a multi-brigade open field battle. When he isn't busy managing a small manufacturing facility in West Tennessee or working on the Mykonos saga, yeah, he's likely to be writing articles as an Orthodox Christian Universalist theologian. Currently, he's helping the British scholar and author known as Gregory MacDonald, hosting the newly established evangelicaluniversalist.com discussion forum. But over the years, he's also posted a few thousand pages of technical discussion on metaphysics and history at sites like christiancadre.blogspot.com. And apparently, he's not kidding about those few thousand pages. So anyway, with that said, welcome to the program, Jason.
Hi, Juanita.
Hi. So a little vague but very intriguing bio, I must say.
Well, like I said, it's one of the most boring.
It's not.
I write stuff, and I used to go to college a long time ago before I graduated.
Well, I have to say, congratulations on Cry of Justice.
Thank you very much.
It's really a very interesting book. And this is your first book?
This is my first novel, yes.
So tell us where you actually started writing. Was it in college? And I mean, you've done all these articles for various blogs. Where did this all begin?
Well, now those are two different questions. The writing of the articles began, actually come to think of it, the writing of the articles began at about the same time. But when I began writing Cry of Justice, the internet had not really been invented yet. So at that time, when I was debating and doing things that was on email, I had a friend of mine, Dr. Victor Revert, who runs the dangerousidea.blogspot.com, I think is where it is. And he's an author and a C.S. Lewis scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And he had read a review of mine of some of Lewis's work and gotten in touch with me, and so introduced me to a bunch of people who were, some of them were theists and some of them were atheists and some were agnostics, and we all just kind of got along and talked with each other for a long time. And then when the internet showed up, then I started doing articles for those. And along the way, I wrote some technical books for my own interest purposes and for my own exercises. Most of those have not been published, but some of them have been published online, especially at the Christian Cadre Journal, which is at christiancadre.blogspot.com.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you poke around there, you can find those pretty easy. Cry of Justice was written, I've been working on the overall series since around 1980.
Oh, are you serious?
Yes.
Wow.
But now, funnily and amusingly enough, Cry of Justice is one of the last things that I started on.
Oh.
I had all the other pieces put together. Well, they weren't quite put together, but they were all in place and for the whole series. And I was thinking, well, you know, how am I going to start this off? Well, I've got to do this and I've got to do that. And so I began putting them together in a sort of order, and I needed to invent a story that started the series, and that's where I came up with the plot for this book, and that began tying in the various characters and introducing various characters. But many of the characters in the novel were invented for the novel, like Portonista and Cyphus, and just kind of went on from there. But now Jean was invented back in the late 80s, I think.
Isn't that interesting? So you had characters popping up for you before the
Yeah, I've got lots of characters that have, I mean, have never even aren't even close to being on paper yet, but I've had them for 20, you know, 25 years, 30 years. The oldest character that I've got is also the preface author from the novel. He's
uh-huh.
the guy who's he's the fictional character who's writing all this down for his wife.
That's so interesting that you did that. You have a preface and introduction
mm-hmm.
written by this very mysterious character, and you don't see that very often.
I think Mary Gentle wrote a series of three or four books about a fictional, kind of a fantastic version of Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
And she did something kind of like that, but I didn't discover this until a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there aren't other, you know, yeah, it's pretty unusual, and I had to do it because I didn't actually want to do it. I have this huge plot, and I've got the ending down, and I'm sitting here thinking, okay, certain things have got to happen. Now, how do I introduce this? Oh, gosh, how do I introduce this character? How do I get this on here? Why is he going back and doing this? So then I had to create this narrative format. So you have this mysterious preface author guy. I like to call him the PA,
mm-hmm.
and he's going to be very, very involved in the series. He's more involved than is obvious here early at the start of the series. But he's already been to the end. He already knows how the series is going to end out. And as far as he's concerned, it's going to end out badly.
Mm-hmm.
And he's scared about this because he had to leave his wife to go deal with this thing and with the situation and couldn't tell her where he was going, couldn't tell her why he was going, which made her suspicious anyway. And then when he came back, he still couldn't tell her where he went or why he had done it because he was just so wiped out by it, he just couldn't figure out where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And that made her annoyed, and so she left to go
so.
Do something else.
Yeah.
and he's like, oh, man, I've got to do something about this. I've got to... Now, it will be people who read that first page, that preface, and start looking through the whole thing. Wait, he's writing this whole thing in a day, and she can read it, and he thinks she can read it in about an hour. But this first book is 444 pages long, and it's the first of a trilogy, and Jason keeps talking about how there's going to be more books after this.
Yeah.
That's a clue. These are not normal people.
Yeah, okay. Right, this is not Earth we're talking about.
No.
Well, why don't you tell us about Mekon?
Mekon.
Mm-hmm.
Mekon. Yeah. It's kind of amusing. After when I was first inventing the name on that, by the way, I had this idea that there was going to be this one large continent in the middle of the planet, and there wasn't really going to be any other continent on the planet. And there's still not really. But that was where I came up with the name of it. I was like, Mekon is middle continent. But then later, I discover, and I'm not entirely sure about this, and I'll take correction if there is some, but I discovered actually earlier this year that Mekon is a Japanese word for action.
Oh, interesting.
So, and that has, I thought that was really nifty. It's totally undesigned. I didn't do that, but action is the distinction between action and reaction and that sort of thing is one of the underlying themes in the story. So I thought
wow.
that came out fairly well.
Yeah, no kidding.
The introduction itself introduces this idea because you have Siphus and he's hunting a deer.
Mm-hmm.
And the distinction between Siphus and the deer is the deer only reacts, and Siphus makes use of that to kill the deer,
mm-hmm.
but then he feels bad about it, you know, and so there's other distinctions going on there. The Siphus can actively introduce these effects into his environment, and the deer can't really do that. But then. Other times, you'll see throughout the series, every once in a while, you'll see where the idea that people are being responsible initiators into the events that are occurring, and that can be good or that can be bad, but it does mean that they're persons, and the villains have this tendency, they don't like action. They don't like other people's actions. They like their own actions.
Yep,
they don't like
yep.
other people's actions. Other people's actions scare them.
Okay.
So either they're going to try to control other people's actions, or they're going to try to destroy them as people or something like that in order to make themselves feel fairly safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fairly common villainy theme throughout the series. You'll see that played out in lots of different ways.
So that's not just for this book?
No, that's not just for this book.
Okay.
But it did amuse me when I learned a few months ago that apparently there is a Japanese word for action called Mekon, and that, so, you know, if someone comes up with that and says, wow, he did that on purpose, no, I can't really take credit for that.
Yeah, but how interesting that it happened like that. That's really neat. So tell us a little, okay, we know about this mysterious character, and you're starting to mention some of the others. So take us through the story in this book, Cry of Justice.
Right.
What happens?
Okay, we've got a, not counting the over giant overarching story, which is supposed to be kind of vague, so don't worry about that. But this first book and the first trilogy, kind of overall, it's about an ambitious young woman, and she's not a very good person. She starts off more than half weak and more than half bad, and gets stronger as she goes. But then as she gets stronger, she has to come to these choices. Is she going to do this thing? Is she going to do that thing? You know, is she going to be selfish? Is she going to be doing something over here that's more selfless? And things don't always go out very well. Sometimes she does some really admirable things, and sometimes she doesn't. She's supposed to become the empress eventually.
Okay.
And that's what she's trying to do. And her idea of what it means to be an empress at this time is different than what the kind of empress she eventually becomes. And this, by the way, introduces the sub-author concept that you've got the preface author, and he's writing the book, but he's basing his story to a large degree on these other books that he's brought back from the con. And she wrote one of them, so she's written this testimony. From starting about 7 years in the future of the main storyline, and she's talking about, you know, I'm this empress, but I used to be this horrible person, and all these people love me, and they've totally forgotten that I used to be this horrible person, and they really need reminding because I feel really bad about it.
Oh, no.
You know, they don't need to be putting me up on a pedestal. They need to be understanding that I went through, you know, a lot of pain and misery here, and I caused a lot of heartache and a lot of trouble. And you know, they.
She doesn't want them to forget.
Person. Yeah, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then there are other sub-authors. Cyphus is one of the sub-authors. He's one of the main characters. He's he is what they call a Zhuakwar, which means that he's part of this group called the Gwakawara, and that means hunting cry, and that's a real world word, by the way. Most of the terms in here do come from the real world, one place or another.
Okay.
And that particular one, Gwakawara, is a word that was used by one or two South American tribes to describe panthers, and it's where we get the word jaguar and where we get the word cougar from.
Oh, interesting.
Both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the con, in the story, The formal name for them is the Gwakawara, the hunting cry, but people call them the Zhuakwara. And if they kind of slur that, you get jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're kind of talking slang, or even when they're kind of being, you know, making a racist slur on them, they'll call them jaguars. But he's really sad. His people have been wiped out recently during the wars that happened just before the main story begins, and he's very depressed. He's gotten in with Fortunista's brigade, and he grew up in a religious environment that was run by a priestess, and loved her very much, like a mom. And everyone was trained to follow these priestesses. Well, the priestesses all disappeared, all of them, all across Makan.
Mm.
And which is normally what happens in Makan right before that's what they call a culling, and it usually happens right before there's this big war. And that's how they reckon the eras when they move from one group of centuries to another.
Okay.
And so she's disappeared, and his brothers and the Gwakawara, they all started fighting one another because they couldn't decide what was right and what was wrong and which people to follow, and they weren't real popular to start with because everyone was scared of them. So the first opportunity everyone gets, they all decide to gang up on Hunting Cry and wipe them out of existence, and he's one of the few remaining survivors. And he ran because he couldn't figure out, he couldn't make a decision about what side was the right side to fight on. And so he's feeling very depressed about that, too, because he feels like, you know, my brothers went out and they took a stand and, you know, they picked sides and they fought, and it was a, you know, horrible tragedy. But at least they picked sides and fought, and here I ran off, you know.
Mm.
So am I a coward? What does that mean? You know?
Right, right.
So now he's found this brigade out in the back end of nowhere where all these people are coalescing together. They're coming from other armies and other brigades that have kind of gotten beaten up, and they're just looking for someone to help put their lives back together and have some safety in numbers. And you have some troops and you have some vendors. They're being led by this young woman, Fortunista.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Cyphus, they're about the same age, and Cyphus, as far as he's concerned, you know, she's kind of like a matron. She's supposed to be the leader. And he has this, you know, very high ideal of how a matron ought to act. And she does not act like that at all, which makes him more depressed. So he can't decide exactly what he's going to do about this. You know, what am I supposed to do about this?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she's supposed to be this great military leader. Well, she's not doing so great at that. She's okay, but she's supposed to be this highly ethical religious leader. Well, she's definitely not doing well at that. And then what makes matters worse is that deep down he's starting to fall in love with her too.
Mm-hmm.
So
little romance in there.
Yeah, and but that kind of runs against, you know, that's like falling in love with your mom sort of. So that can't be right.
Yeah.
So now, you know, they're not really. I mean, they're not related remotely, and they're about the same age. So it would in fact be proper for him to marry her if he ever got around to it. But she's scared of him, and he's scared of her. So, you know, there's definitely some tension going on.
So were they the main characters then that will go through the whole trilogy?
They will go through the whole trilogy. There are several. They are two of the three main characters, and you will see them through the whole trilogy. I mean, the first trilogy is called the Penitent Empress Trilogy, so
mm-hmm.
you know, she's the Penitent Empress. This is her story of how she got to be the Empress in the first three books.
Mm-hmm.
Cyphus, I'll go ahead and just say, you know, Cyphus will go through it. If you look on my Amazon journal, you can see that there's... I've been putting in references, been tracking my composition of the second and third book, and you know there are references to Cyphus, obviously. So he survives into well into book three anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about 2/3 of the way through writing book three, and I had to take a break because I was just about getting ready to start all the big grand finale action sequences, and all of a sudden Portunista decides to do something that makes perfect sense for her character. And it'll probably end up improving the story any, but I have no idea how that's going to affect my plans for the end of the book.
Oh, so she took it into her own hands.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, she has this tendency to do that.
I have heard that happens in writing, especially fantasy writing.
Yeah, well, it does. And,
mm-hmm.
and that means that, and I like it when that happens because it means that I've been doing pretty good creating a character. I've got the situation set up, I've got her character and her characterization set up. And so as I'm sitting here plotting out, you know, things are going to do, suddenly she'll just decide to do something. And I'm thinking, well, no, wait, whoa. Wait, is this, what are you doing? Is this bad or good or this doesn't fit into my plans?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that helps out, amazingly. I guess that's the back subconscious back part of my mind, you know, working on plot and coming up with the solution to things. I remember when I was writing the first book, there was a scene, most of the first book, once you get out past the first section of chapters, all deals with this, with a tower. It's called the Tower of Carfax. Carfax is the guy who built the tower.
Uh-huh.
And he's a magician, used to be one of Portunista's teachers back in the cadre. No relation to the Christian cadre, by the way. I wrote the book long before. And she has figured out where this tower is. And she wants the loot. It's a tower looting. It's a loot.
Uh-huh.
Right? You know, she's going to go down there and get the loot out of this tower. So she gets down there oh goodness, I've forgotten my point. Oh yeah, right. We're in this tower and they've been exploring the tower and they've run across these places where the troops used to sleep, the garrison used to sleep. And there are bed slats there and these slats are filled with sod and the sod has quitch grass growing on it. And quitch grass is, again, it's one of those real world words. It's, quitch is basically couch. Where we get the word for couch.
Oh, okay.
Couch.
Uh-huh.
And several other things that are a little bit more PG-13 to talk about.
Okay.
But, well, that's just how that is. You know, coach and couch and a few other words in our slang all come from the same word, okay?
Yes.
Okay, so this moss that people sleep on because, you know, it's just cheap. It's something handy out there, and you get a good night's sleep on it. And so people, you know, they're living out in the boonies, they'll harvest the sod and they'll put it in these slats and they'll sleep on it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it's the first
towers,
mattress.
Yeah, that's why it's exactly right. It's a
mm-hmm.
mattress. And people used to do that in real life.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe.
I believe it.
Yeah. So they're in this tower and it's been several, I'm going to say months, that's not right. It's several slopings, but the Makan has no moon, so I can't call them months.
Mm-hmm.
I have to call them something else, and I might get back to that later. But it's been there for more than a year. So when did, you know, why aren't these things dead? But they're not. They're growing. And so I'm sitting here. I've gotten through three sections of chapters, and there's been some really intense things that have occurred. But things are looking pretty well at the moment. And I'm kind of doing a stream of conscious writing where I'm in Port Denise's head and kind of thinking about some stuff. And she's pretty happy with how things have turned out so far. And I'm noticing that in the back of her mind, she's thinking about this grass. Something was bugging her about this grass. And I thought, well, you know, something's bugging me about this grass. What is it? And I suddenly realized while I'm in the middle of writing this chapter, the grass should be dead, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the grass green? Why is it still alive?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, man, I've messed up the plot. How am I going to fix this? What am I going to do? All of a sudden, she sits up in bed and goes, it means somebody is coming back. Someone has been here, and they're planning on coming back.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's what I wrote. That's what I put into the chapter.
Uh-huh.
Which is true. I mean, you know, it's true. It makes sense.
I love that. That is so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I can come up with several other examples of that too. But in the third book, there's a character who's very similar to her, and I won't go too far into that because I don't want to get spoilery on the plot.
Yeah, don't do that.
But she decides to burn off this guy's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
She's hacked off, and she's just kind of nuking the area and keeping him alive, but burns off his clothes. Well, I wasn't planning on that. And she's done it, and now I'm sitting there thinking, okay, that makes sense. I can't really have – I mean, it's a really powerful scene. She's mad at somebody else, not him directly, although he kind of reminds her of the person she's mad at. And I'm thinking, okay, it makes sense for her to do that. That's in character. It looks really great. But the problem is that, you know, I can keep him alive. She can keep him alive, but she can't do this and also keep the clothes. So the clothes have got to be burned away. Oh, gosh, now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
So now I've created this situation of where this guy is going to be running around for the next several chapters without any clothes on.
With no clothes.
Yeah, because he's got no way of getting any. He's out in the middle of nowhere.
That's not the book you intended to write.
No. And it made for an interesting action sequence in the middle of the book because he's got to swoop in and he isn't going to save the day, but in fact he doesn't do all that much. He's just the fact that he's around,
mm-hmm,
kind of helps out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he's got to do this naked. And I wasn't planning on this. So I figured, well, you know, I might as well do it. So I've got him going through this whole fight sequence and people are not expecting him to be there anyway. And when he shows up, they're like, what did I just see? Did that?
Yeah.
What? What was that? So
that's a good strategy.
Yeah. So we get to make the nice thing about being a fantasy writer, and that's probably true about all authors too, when they're creating these things.
I think with fantasy, it's so interesting because you're creating a completely different world, different characters. I mean, it boggles my mind that you could actually keep that all straight.
Yeah. Well, I make notes.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Lots of notes. And sometimes I'll when I'm pre-plotting a sequence, I'll come up with musical tracks in my head, and I'll find music tracks from my library, and I'll pre-plot the sequence using these musical tracks.
Oh, wow.
But then usually, it's a mnemonic device.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I write the scene, they rarely fit the musical tracks. But that's okay. You know, I throw them out and use something else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But, it's easier to do that than to write historical fiction, because writing historical fiction, if you're going to be responsible about it, you've got to go out and research all these things that have occurred,
mm-hmm,
and you want to fit in with that. You don't want to just write something implausible because, you know, 500 people will suddenly stand up and go, that didn't happen. It was something else.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Are you out of your mind?
Then there goes the credibility.
Yeah, there goes your credibility.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And
yeah.
So.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Whether you've already written your manuscript or are contemplating writing one, you will need to create a book proposal. ReaderViews has a coaching service to help you create an enticing book proposal for your work of fiction or nonfiction. In fact, ReaderViews will even submit your book proposal to publishers and agents they have created a relationship with, and then they promise to pursue these submissions. Go to ReaderViews.com today and click on Services for Authors to find out more information on book proposals and how ReaderViews can help you. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with author Jason Pratt. His new book, Cry of Justice, is available now, and you can go to Amazon.com to purchase it.
And there's, you know, you want to respect the people who are actually there. These people don't exist. Now, I'm doing my best to, you know, treat them like they do exist and respect them and everything. But these other people in history really did exist, and you want to be, you know, you don't want to slander or libel. I guess it would be libel because it's in print. You don't want to libel dead people.
Yeah, true.
You know, even if they're cruds, you don't want to say bad things about them necessarily because, you know,
Now, let me ask you a little bit about the religious themes in here, and because there, you know, you have quite a background in metaphysics, theology, that sort of thing. So, is there a little bit that's slipping into this book?
Mm-hmm. There's quite a more than a few.
Really?
There are more than a few things running around in the book. I do try to play fair. It's not a situation where everybody on one side is always completely correct and everybody on the other side is always completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's numerous different sides, for one thing, and they all tend to have something pretty important and pertinent to say. Sometimes everybody gets to be somewhat right, everybody gets to be somewhat wrong. Even the preface author, when he's writing things, he is a distinct character, and he doesn't always understand what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I understand the plot, and you know, so I introduce mistakes and he's thinking one thing when really something else.
So, what are some of the spiritual themes, though, that you're kind of playing around with?
Well, okay, in the first, I'll give an example because it's pretty early in the book. Cyphus is depressed. I've been talking about this. He starts off the novel, just, you know, thinking. Well, it's a classic problem of evil. Life sucks. There's evil stuff happening. Why isn't anybody doing anything about this? You know, why do bad things have to be occurring? And he's gotten to the point where, you know, is there any reason even for me to continue? And he's thinking about suicide.
Lost his faith.
Yeah. And so he's decided, you know, if he can't really come up with a good reason for him to continue living, then he might as well kill himself. So he starts, you know, he's saying, you know, what is my problem really? And he's like, well, I've got this feeling in my heart that, you know, things aren't right, and I need to know if I have any hope that things are ever going to get better. And so what he does is he works out and it doesn't take very long. It's a fairly short chapter. But he works out what a metaphysician would call an argument from morality. You know, it's saying, well, you know, we've got these various ideas in our mind. Where did these come from? Did they come from here? Well, they couldn't have come from here because that would be nonsense. They couldn't have come from here because that wouldn't make it. They couldn't have come from here. And he's going through these various options concerning what morality, can you just write morality off? Is morality an illusion? And he eventually comes to the conclusion, no, I can't. You know, I can't get rid of it. Or I might as well kill myself. You know, if I don't have any hope for justice to come, you know, to kick in here and for things to come out right, I might as well kill myself. So, but he decides that, you know, these other things can't explain the cry of justice in his heart. That's where the title of the book comes from, to a large degree. And so he makes a resolution that, you know, he's going to, in effect, he resolves to believe in God. And it doesn't come cried out and say that. And everyone in the story more or less believes in God anyway, but they all have different opinions about it. And so his concept here is, you know, can I have at least some assurance that God's not just going to leave everything here to rot? Is he going to do something and bring everything up together? So he decides, yeah, he can. You know, he'll keep at it and keep on going. And but then later in the book, he meets one of the Juakawara, a slightly older guy, and you know, he's overjoyed. He's like, oh yeah, one of my brothers, cool, everything's going to come out all right. Well, this guy has been through the same, you know, angsty process, and he's come up with some rather different conclusions. So the other side gets to come out and play for a while, and Cyphus gets the rug yanked out from him pretty badly. I remember one of my early readers, she said, I thought that was really cool how he yanked the rug out from Cyphus there. So then he, you know, up until then, everything was going on, you know, pretty well for him, and you know, things were looking up, and then he meets his brother, and his brother's got these other ideas, and they sound pretty plausible, but he ought to be happier about it because he's met his brother, but now things are worse somehow, and so, you know.
Varying points of view. It's interesting.
Yeah, there's different points of view on the subject. Now, I don't leave it alone with that either, because, you know, a few chapters later, another character is bringing out another point that scientists hadn't considered, but I don't, you know, it's not like I'm ending the novel saying, and this was the end. You know, there's a lot of ambiguity and unresolved things that still have to come out.
So this is very, you can make comparisons to kind of the modern world that we're living in.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I can make comparisons. Of course, a lot of these themes are timeless, and
sure.
So, you know, you can apply them in many different ways. Everybody wants to know, you know, why do bad things happen?
Yeah,
what,
of course.
What does that mean exactly, the bad things happen? What does it mean that we even think that they're bad? But then there's, I don't want to get too specific. I really never had anything specific in mind about specific events, and I feel like I kind of ought to point that out because the book was written late 2000, early 2001. Well, that was several months before 9/11.
Yeah. There's political, very interesting political comparisons that are in here.
Yeah, there can be. I mean, because you've got this main character, Portonista, who's, you know, a lot of the other characters in the book are going, can we really trust her? Can, you know, she's dangerous and she might hurt us. And but she's the leader, but should we throw her out? Should we keep following her? What are we supposed to do about this? What are her goals? Are those things that we need to be trying to support? And, you know, you could, if you wanted to, apply that to the kind of leadership we've had over the past few years, or maybe fixing to have now, you know, and say, well, you know, I'm not real sure I trust this guy in charge. How do we proceed? Mm-hmm. Even, you know, he's in charge, given that, but then how are we going to go about this? But then on the other hand, if you try to read it into it as like, well, he's critiquing George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
We better be careful with that because, you know, most of the novel is set up to say, go Portonista.
Oh, really? Oh.
So it's like, well, it's
you
like having a Michael Moore film slagging Bush, and then at the end of he turns around and says, well, you know, you ought to be following him.
And vote for him.
Yeah. So, wait, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Wait, how did this come out in the book? Wait, it's the... So it's more complex than people may be expecting, and it's probably a better idea not to try to apply it to any particular political thing that's going on in the real world. But there are general themes that are always applicable.
Okay. Well, I knew that there were some strong parallels and that people had mentioned that and were wondering that about you. And then so I was going to ask you, you know, for your second book, if you're going to put any predictions in there, because, I mean, we just went through a monumentous election.
Oh, yeah,
so.
Yeah. No, the second book's already written, so I'm and most of the third book's already written.
Yeah.
So, and keeping in mind, I've already got another whole trilogy plotted out, and I've got stuff going on after that, so I've got these things that are occurring in already that are planned.
Mm-hmm.
The second book, I really don't know to what extent it can be. I don't know if there's anything in the second book that could be read. You know, the first book has a tower, and you know, not to be too spoilery about it, the tower implodes at the end of the book. So, and I know people are going to go, he took the towers from September 11 and put it into this book.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I wrote the book about 6 months before then.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, but it really freaked me out when that happened. I thought, oh, man, and what's worse is nobody's ever going to believe that. I didn't do that.
We believe it.
So, but, you know, the second book, Portonista, you know, she survives the first book and comes out pretty well, she's got a small army now, not just a brigade, and a bunch of people have joined her up with her, but now what do you do? She's out in the back end of nowhere, she's got these troops and even more vendors and non-military personnel that have got to be protected and helped, and they can't just live out there by themselves. They've got to get somewhere for the winter. The winter's coming on. It's not there yet. I mean, but you don't just wait until winter shows up and then try to go somewhere. You've got to go somewhere now while the getting's good.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a city nearby, and they decide, well, let's go raid that city. Or let's go to the city and see if we can get them to let us sign up to help them over the winter. But if that's not going to happen, maybe we should just invade. And so, you know, that's more than a little morally ambiguous.
No kidding.
So,
where are
you
going with this?
And things do not go well.
Uh-huh.
There are people who have read the first book and, you know, wanted to slap Portonista upside the head at the end. And I'm like, you really don't even want to throw her out a window yet. Just wait till you get to the end of book two. You're really going to be wanting to throw her out a window.
Oh, geez.
But she does say at the end of the first book, you know, she gets better, but she gets worse first, and that's all her own fault. So,
So you actually have another trilogy planned for this same...
Yeah, for the same character, for Portonista. Of course, the first three books are getting her to the point where she becomes the Empress. And then the next three books, I don't have a title for the trilogy yet, but I do have titles for the book.
That's such an ambitious endeavor you're taking on.
Well, and by the time those three books are done, that generation will be over. Most of the people will be dead.
Mm-hmm.
Blunt. New generations are coming on. There's a seventh book that I've got setting up that, in effect, it kills off everybody else who's in the, who's not, you know, who was in the plot of the first six books who's still alive,
mm-hmm.
and kind of passes the torch along to the next stage of the story arcs. And, you know, every two or three books I've got a new arc going on, but it's all one big story, and it's heading toward a particular conclusion.
Okay, so you've got that mapped out.
Oh, yeah, very much mapped out. If you read the first page of the first book, the preface, you know what's going to happen.
Okay.
Everything's going to blow up and everyone's going to die,
which
is bad.
Right.
you
go to tell how it happened.
And this is exactly right, because that's what the preface author is doing. He's like, you know, I just came back from a con. Everyone blew up and died, and frankly, I blame myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really sure how to explain this to my wife. So what do I do? How do I explain this to her? She's not going to like this.
Oh, that's interesting.
So he has gone back now and is trying to figure out how it got to this point.
Mm-hmm.
And
I can see how you've made some metaphysical parallels, you know, with some ancient civilizations and ideas of what's happened. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of a Ragnarok. Of course, you know, you look at what happened to the Adelphas, the priests and the priestesses, and they all disappeared. Well,
mm-hmm.
that's a rapture, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but then, so you're thinking, oh, what Jason's going to do, he's going to do Revelation John. Yeah, you know, there's some things in there that might show up in the series later. I have plans, but the fact of the matter is that a lot of it is like Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eventually the giants are going to fight off against everybody else, and the giants are going to win,
mm-hmm.
and everything's going to get destroyed. So what do you do about that? If you know that, you know, if things are going really bad and you know, that's when character really gets forged, you know, or when things are going bad and getting worse, you know,
in
are
crisis.
You going to be a
yep.
are you going to be what kind of person are you going to be
right.
during that time?
Mm-hmm. Now, how influenced were you by some of the greats like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis?
Tolkien, of course, everybody's influenced by Tolkien,
mm-hmm.
and to a certain extent nowadays, and this has been true for the last 20 or 30 years, too, it's a question of, I'm influenced by Tolkien, but I'm doing stuff differently.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
even when you're doing stuff differently, you're reacting to Tolkien.
Interesting.
So it's like, I'm like Tolkien in these respects, but I'm not like Tolkien in these other respects. I do things some other way.
Mm-hmm.
But Tolkien is the standard. I mean, he's the standard. You can't get past it. He's the guy who, and he's there for a reason. I mean, he's obviously the standard for a reason. He was the guy who really kicked off modern fantasy writing and pulled all these elements together and
Brilliant.
Did it really well.
Mm-hmm.
And he set the template. He set the bar.
Yeah.
You know, so people are either vaulting the bar or they're going around the bar or they're going some other way from the bar, but the bar is there.
Yeah.
You know, he's... He was a great linguist, and there's a to a certain extent you could say that he wrote his huge, and he had a big, huge epic story too, not just the Lord of the Rings. It had this vast, vast mythology that he had going on forward and back and prologues and
mm-hmm.
stuff. So.
Mm-hmm.
And there's to a certain extent you could say that he invented all this just so that he could work with the languages. He loved languages. That was his thing, and so he wanted to create all these languages, and he had to come up with a history for the languages, and so that's what I was about. I can't do languages. I'm not real good with languages. I love languages. I love studying languages. I love messing around with languages, but I'm not very good at it.
Mm.
You know, there's that dedication at the front of the book. That's my idea of a language that sounds kind of alien and weird, and it does translate out, but you're not going to see a lot of it in the book because I'm not very good at that sort of thing. I'm more likely to pick up words from various cultures all over the world and all over history and put them into the story, like punky, for instance. Punks, you know, you think, oh, that's American slang. Well, actually, punk is what the American Indians, and I forget which tribe it was, but the Native Americans, they used to call gnats.
Oh, interesting.
That's where we get the word punk from. And that's why punk means something that's a little tiny, buzzy, you know, annoying thing, this little tiny annoying thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, that's because that's what it was. That's what the Indians called gnats. They were punks.
Oh, I love that.
So in the book, I want people to use that slang, you know, you punky something or other. And okay, well, that they're talking about these gnats.
Mm-hmm.
So in an early chapter, I'm introducing the ash punkies, these little gnats that live in the ashes in the fire. That's
mm-hmm.
where these other gnats that the Indians had to deal with too. They were also living.
That's so creative.
Yeah. Well, and they come out. I can't really spoil it. In book three, they turn out to be there's a group of punky gnats that turn out to be rather more important than anyone has ever guessed.
Okay.
You know, I'm building all these things in from way back, but that's my idea of how to use words. I'll pick up words. I'll go through my dictionary and look at the how words were used once upon a time and come up with something. Oh, okay, that makes sense. I'll write that down and I'll put it into the book somewhere.
That's really unique.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your writing style, too, because you write in a very poetic style.
Well, I write, and that happened by kind of accident.
Really?
I had written the first book. First book drafted at 206,000 words, rather too much. So I got it after the first real big edit. I pulled it down to 194,000, 106,000. And for several years, I just could not get it down any further. Mm. Seriously, I was aiming for around 100, 150. I eventually got to 150.
Mm.
So I was working on trying to edit the book. I did not like the way I hated the subauthor and the preface authors and all that. Everyone's going to hate that, and nobody does like it. To be honest, to be blunt, nobody likes it, and that's okay. I mean, I understand. I do the best I can with it. But I was like, I've got to get rid of it. And I couldn't get rid of it because of the plot logic. And I had to try to come down. But I was trying to cut down on the number of words, okay, to bring down the word count, especially at the beginning. Because if I can get people past those first several chapters, they're home free.
Yeah.
But those first several chapters are the toughest.
Yeah, you got to capture them.
They've got this huge, you've got this huge, steep, learning curve that you're dealing with here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the first nine chapters, they all take 45 pages total. So I did manage to bring it down. But at the time, they were pretty big, and I was trying to trim them down. I went through so many times trying to draft it. Well, I decided to take a break. I just burned out on it.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in January of 2005, maybe. Well, my idea of taking a break is to get out the Greek manuscripts for the New Testament texts and do a search through the gospel text, trying to figure out time and place keys. This is my idea of a break.
Oh, God.
I had to do something else.
I'm
doing this study. Well, now that I've done the study, I think I'll just write it down.
Yeah.
So now I'm writing it down, and I'm trying to do this translation, and I'm thinking, well, at the way these things got passed along was because they were mnemonic originally. They had some kind of rhythm to them, and we've more or less lost the rhythm. But at the time, if you kind of poke around, you can get an idea of what the original rhythm was. So I thought, I'll try to do that in my writing and with the gospel translations. I'll try to make that out. And that, if you go to the Christian Cadre site, you can look on the sidebar on the right. It says KOS, King of Stories, the Harmonization Project. And you click on that, and it goes through there's this huge index that brings everything up. And you can read through that, and you can see what I've done. I've written everything in rhythmic scansion. It's kind of a varying rhythm, and by the time I got through with that, my brain was so saturated with that, I was doing it in everything.
Mm.
So I go back to the book, and I start writing the book, and I'm starting trying to edit the book, and the book's already written. I'm editing the book, and I'm like, oh, man, that rhythm sucks. I'm going to get rid of that. I'll move the words around on this. Oh, okay, that sounded pretty good. Okay, I'll do this next. Oh, that sentence sucks also. I'll move the words around. Well, after I had done about a chapter,